It was a crisp fall day at our country home in North Carolina. I had raked the yard, pulling up leaves and twigs and other stuff into a nice brush pile, and came in for lunch. Carolyn asked, "Aren't you going to burn it?" "No, I think it's a bit too windy." "Oh, you're just being lazy. Go out and start it." Well, I did, and soon the wind-whipped flames were racing toward the house and the woods. I tried to fight it with a little rake and a little garden hose while she was calling the volunteer fire department. And fortunately, Mac, her dad, was coming up the hill on his tractor with plow mounted. And he came quickly and cut two swaths of dirt around that fire wide enough so that it didn't jump. What a beautiful I told you so moment. Didn't have to say a word. When a fire breaks out on a field from not far from your home, you do feel uneasy. And if the wind picks up and starts to blow in your direction, your uneasiness quickly grows even into panic. And knowing how helpless you are to fight it, that you need others to help up and fight the flames. It wasn't that long ago that there was a moving forest fire right here in the valleys, threatening homes in Rainbow and other neighborhoods. I watched helicopters, as you may have, lift buckets of water out of Turnagain Arm and drop it on the flames. And before that fire reaches your house, you start to grab things that are important to you, ready to make your getaway. And if the fire continues to grow, destroying other homes in your neighborhood, all of you will, with the same exit strategy, without planning anything, get ready to run. And as you drive away, you cry out to God, pleading to him to turn the direction of the winds and bring rain. Do whatever you can to stop that inferno before it destroys everything in its path. Speaking of infernos, on September 11, 2001, our country caught on fire. I was flying to Kenya as brutal terrorists started the blaze and more than 3,000 people perished. Since then, the winds have picked up speed and are now blowing in our direction, and the flames of terrorism at home and abroad are out of control. Our need is not only to find safety, it's to find God. For our entire world is now on fire, and we hope to survive. But that's an impossible plan if we try to do it alone. We need help. Help from God, as he tells us what to do. And once that happens, we need to handle this inferno exactly as he directs. Devastating forest fires don't suddenly erupt full force. They ignite with a spark and expand. And all of us can recall in our minds the bleak images of raging fire consuming thousands of acres of forest and homes, as high winds and extremely dry conditions in California and Colorado combined with all things flammable to create a fiery monster, upending the lives and threatening the livelihoods of countless unsuspecting people. And as enormously devastating as these become, forest fires, like all fires, begin and progress in a short series of eerily predictable stages. I've been reading up on fires, and they have declared first there's an incipient stage where the fire initially ignites. Extremely dry conditions, elevated temperatures combined with some outside element, usually very small. A half-smoked cigarette flipped into a patch of dry weeds. The inevitable burst of sparks around an evening campfire landing randomly on some dry timber or a quarter mile away, a bolt of lightning from a summer storm hitting the arid ground. The fire begins incipiently. And next comes the growth stage. Soon the smoldering ember whips into a flame that begins to its insidious advance across dry, wooded areas, vacuuming up oxygen and heat and dry particles from the surrounding, growing into a moving and ever-increasing wall of fire. The third stage is fire becomes fully developed. And in this stage, the fire is at its hottest, most dangerous level, spreading rapidly as quickly as maybe 20 miles an hour, consuming everything combustible in its path. Firefighters fear this stage the most because of what they refer to as the dreaded flashover, when a treacherous wall of fire can literally leap a barricade and as if in a daring surprise attack. It can overwhelm those furiously battling the firefight. Finally, fire enters what is called the stage of decay. And this is the point where the flames begin to die out, either because of moisture, cooler conditions, or because the fire simply runs out of consumable fuel sources. And still the danger lurks, because this is the stage when a backlash can occur, backdraft, as oxygen drifts back into still, volatile, confined spaces and reignites the flame. Evangelist Billy Graham was prophetic in his instincts when he wrote decades ago his powerful volume, The World of Flame. In it, Dr. Graham warned of a coming time in history when life as we know it will be consumed by evil. That evil wave, like a forest fire, would begin incipiently, virtually unnoticed. But eventually unchecked, it would blaze across our culture with devastating results. Most of us were quietly going about our festive Thanksgiving celebrations in November of 2015. We can still remember the shocking images broadcast on our TV screens, bloodied corpses strewn about a large concert hall in downtown Paris, several hooded and heavily armed radical Islamic terrorists had stormed into the dark and loud music venue and had gunned down patrons in cold blood, shouting allegiance, praise to Allah. Do you remember that dreadful scene? The longer that night dragged on, the more clearly the horror of what had actually happened unfolded before our eyes. The footage being broadcast from Paris was gruesome. ISIS quickly took credit for that hideous ordeal. A tingling shot, a chill ran up our spines. For if they could make it to Paris, going to a musical concert, why should we think it's even okay to go to a mall? Like the mall in Nairobi, Kenya that I was shopping at the year before terrorists overtook that shopping center. Writing in his book, Finding God When the World's on Fire, Chuck Swindoll comments, "The raging flames of Islamic terrorism have grown into a fully developed forest fire of fear, mind-boggling violence, seemingly complete and total disregard for boundaries to its destruction. And in shock, we ask, are you there, God? I've lived to see presidential assassinations, prejudicial assassinations, political assassinations, horrible suicide attacks. I've watched as young men and veterans of our conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan stumble back to America's shores, many struggling in the grip of post-traumatic stress. unable to rebuild their lives since they are crippled or blinded or paralyzed from devastating wounds to both body or spirit. At West Point, I listened to the guilt-ridden bombardier of the man who released the A-bomb over Nagasaki. And how about the deadly explosions in the harbor at Texas City or at the Boston Marathon or the U.S. Embassy in Benghazi? We ask, oh Lord, are you there? Chuck comments, in my over 80 years on this earth, I thought I had just about seen it all until the brutal beheadings began. Stunningly broadcast live on the internet, Christians and Muslims and children and fathers, sons and community leaders, mercilessly executed before our very eyes by ISIS in the name of their diabolical religion of rage. And what started incipiently decades ago in a spark of conflict in the arid desert of the Middle East has now developed into a fully raging fire, sickening evil, unlike anything the world's ever known, and it's spreading across continents. What we believe about the proponents of this violence is that they are totally evil, demonic. Their tactics are designed to instill terror and paralyzing fear through their repeated and increasingly savage acts of aggression. And the most recent acts of heinous violence demonstrate to the world the depths to which Hamas and other radical extremists are willing to go to throw even more fuel on the fire. Yet a question lingers in our minds. In the midst of all of the flames, is it possible for someone to find God? Yes, there's something about the human heart that when the heat is on, it softens toward things of the Lord. Solomon wrote, sorrow is better than laughter, for sadness has a refining influence on us, Ecclesiastes 7:3. And quote, enjoy prosperity while you can, but when the hard times strike, realize that they both come from the hand of God. Remember that nothing is certain in this life, Ecclesiastes 7:14. The late Ray Steadman once told of a conversation he had with a retired sea captain. And that seasoned mariner recounted stories of navigating his ship through some wild waters. Storms of enormous strength battered his ship. He told of one particular intense storm when he wasn't certain anyone on board would actually survive. And he said, yes, the Lord heard the voices of many strangers that night. I'm sure God is hearing the voices of many during these treacherous days. Maybe one of those voices is yours. Perhaps in the midst of the raging flames of fear and the searing heat of such perilous times, we begin to ask, can we find God when the world's on fire? I assure you, you're not alone. We can lift up words of hope that we find in the ancient yet relevant book of Psalms. Psalm 11 is one place to go. It was written by David, Israel's shepherd king, at a time when his life was feeling unhinged. He was being hunted and haunted by King Saul, who was determined to kill him. David's words offer insight into the reality of fear and the contrasting power of faith. David had received a warning from a close advisor, urging him to run to the hills for safety like a bird flying to the mountains. Instead, David paused and considered a compelling question found in Psalm 11, verse 3. If the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? Great question. Webster tells us that a foundation is the basis upon which something stands or is supported. Every house has a foundation. Every significant structure, every multi-storied high-rise has a foundation. The taller the building, the deeper and more substantial its foundation. And if you destroy the building's foundation, you've toppled everything. Foundations are everything. And if our foundations are in place, then nothing else really matters. That's precisely David's point in Psalm 11. David is not referring to literal structures or great works of art or layered stones that comprise enormous fortress walls. David's psalm is about standing firm in life when one's entire world seems on fire, when devastation seems imminent. The righteous, people whose lives are rightly related to God by faith in Jesus Christ, we stand on a firm foundation. Now, should the foundations of life be destroyed, that life crumbles. But if the foundation remains secure, no amount of stress, in David's case, no brutal attack on his life by Saul, or painful backstabbing from his own son, Absalom, would cause his life to fracture, ultimately crumble. David envisioned those threats as arrows coming from warriors. And in his psalm, he uses a vivid picture in verse 2. The wicked are stringing their bows. They're fitting their arrows on the bowstrings. They shoot from the shadows to those whose hearts are right. And in those days, the warrior was an excellent marksman, known for his keen ability to shoot with the bow and arrow. And one of the most effective weapons in David's day was a sharp, slender arrow as it slipped from the bow, guided by the archer's eye to the target. David's point was that the wicked had him secretly in their sights, and they were stealthily getting ready to attack. What a fitting metaphor for our times. We face a constant threat of unseen, spontaneous attacks. We can relate to David's advisors, whoever they were at the time, by responding in fear and panic as we retreat. But yet David would have none of that. He strengthened his resolve to respond in faith, not in fear. He declared it at the outset of the poem, "I trust in the Lord for protection." And then again in verse 4, "But the Lord is in his holy temple. The Lord still rules from heaven. He watches everyone closely, examining each person on earth." What a magnificent declaration of confidence in the Lord. David's soul was definitely not on the run. His spirit refused to melt amid the encroaching flames of opposition, danger. His refuge was in the Lord. As you well know, a refuge is a place of hiding, a place of secure protection. The term is chasa in the ancient Hebrew. A chasa is a protective enclosure that provides safety from that which would otherwise consume everything in its path. It's an impenetrable firewall of protection from danger, distress, from anxiety, from fear. And David makes it clear that the Lord alone is his chasa. He remained firm in his confidence in the Lord. His foundation of trust could not be shaken. He was fully human, but he found incredible stability in his divine refuge. That old country preacher was right when he said, "I may tremble on the rock, but the rock don't tremble under me." So keep in mind, David had no corner on confidence. Faith is our solid foundation too. A foundation of faith, not fear. That is our refuge, our chasa. It enables us to stand firm. For the Lord is good, a stronghold in the day of trouble. He is close to those who trust in him. Selah.